alternative view. This is CII.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Friday edition. Today's date is the 7th day of November 2008, and it's great to have you here with me today. My name is Darrell Bradford Smith. We have another installment of the French Connections, most important of broadcasts. More information coming out every day about our financial malaise, ladies and gentlemen. Lots of information on IamTheWitness.com. I want to bring your attention to a file done by a man named James Willey. He has an incredible take on this mess, not different than mine. In fact, he's come to his information over the last 6 months. I actually shared mine over a year ago, but he says some new things about the depth of the credit swaps and interesting things about Lehman Brothers. But what everyone needs to know out there in the listening audience is that if you are in a Pan-African nation or in a Middle Eastern country or in South America, wherever you're listening to the French Connection from, any one of the 152 countries that you're listening from, you will note then that you will not go unblemished or injured by this mess that's coming. So prepare yourselves. Buy canned food. If you're permitted in your society to own firearms, you should own one, and all of the rest of the warnings that anybody prudent would take. I urge everybody in the American market listening to this broadcast that if they are able legally to buy a firearm, that they should get one immediately. I would get a whole bunch of them if I was permitted to, including lots of ammunition, because things are going to go south in the United States terribly. The dollar is finished. There will be no dollar in 6 months, and there will be martial law declared. And the people that will be implementing that martial law will not be looking out for your safety. In fact, they will be carrying out the crimes, the criminal actions of their masters, and those masters will not be looking out for the best interest of the public. So bear that in mind as you go forward with your planning on how to get through this terrible, terrible mess coming up. Anyway, tonight we have a guest coming on. She's been on the French Connection with me some years ago. I think it's about a year and a half ago, in fact, now. Knows a lot about the problems faced by the Palestinians, because not only has she been to Palestine, but she's made it her point to study the crimes of the Israeli government and how they have systematically destroyed the Palestinian people. Not only has she chronologized the history of that destruction, but she has actually got some personal takes on how it was done, why it was done, and she's written a book about it, which we will be talking to her about. Her name is Jennifer Dixon, and I'm going to bring her up right now. Jennifer, are you with me?
I am, indeed. Can you hear me?
Yes, barely. Jennifer, if you could speak loudly, it would help for my listeners to hear and for me.
How about this?
That's much better. We've got a long-distance call coming out of South Africa, ladies and gentlemen, and part of it's in France, the other part of it's in California, so please bear with us if the sound is not perfect. Maybe the engineer can jack up your voice a little bit side.
All right, I'm right out of window. I'm not outside because of the competition from trucks.
Okay. Jennifer, as long as you can speak slowly and clearly, I'll be able to hear you. First of all, I want to talk to you a little bit about your website. You have a website, so let's give everybody the information on how to get to your information first off.
Okay, my website is called Holy Land Unveiled, www.holylandunveiled.com. And anyway, you can go there, and I have a book. I have a second book, which I wrote about the Gaza, Go to Gaza, and it details what happened to the Gaza before 2005 and how it was intentionally destroyed. Then there's a book I wrote about my trip to the West Bank in 2005, and that's called Holy Land Unveiled, and you can download that book as an e-book. There's also a free photo tour, and you can see photos of the way it looks and the way it is, and there's also, I just recently added some audio files, four audio files, so which also go into the history a little bit more, because I do think that's so important, and people have never heard the correct history.
Well, let's talk a little bit about current events there, and you can work your way back into a little bit of the history. I've just read a recent article that said over the last year and a half, 30,000 new olive trees have been uprooted. Now, not new olive trees. These olive trees have been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. But 30,000 olive trees in the recent round of destruction. How much of that Palestinian and Gaza and West Bank area relies on olive production for their income?
Well, about 100,000 farmers, 100,000 people rely on the olive tree for their income. And I don't know the figure, 30,000 for this year. I do know that by the time the wall is finished, a million trees will have been uprooted. Now, they have 10 million trees, olive trees, that is, in Palestine. So that represents 10% of the entire number of trees just for the wall. Now, there are also trees being uprooted in land confiscations.
Yeah.
And a lot of the land around the settlements is also being confiscated, and that's where the olive trees are, by and large, on the West Bank. They're on these, they're right by these settlements. And what's been happening this year is the settler violence against Palestinian farmers has jumped.
Yeah.
And they are just attacking them and beating them up and driving them off this land, claiming, of course, that it's Israeli and it's theirs, and it's land that they've stolen from the Palestinian farmers. And when they just try to go there and collect their olives so that they can get an income and eat, they are being attacked. And that's bad enough, but they're being aided and vetted by the military, who at some point used to sit and watch, but now they're helping. They're actually aiding the settlers in their attacks on these people.
Well, you know, Jennifer, I'm going to remind you, and maybe you can make some parallels to it, because I think it is an important parallel. The American government and the American settlers early in the settlement of America were acting in the exact same way as the Israelis against the American Indians, and they had the assistance of the Army of the United States against them as well. You see the same thing happening in Hawaii, where they were killing the native Hawaiians and stealing their land and driving them off their property. And then today, the Hawaiian people are only a tiny minority of their own country. So the fact is that we've seen this throughout history, but we're seeing it in a modern context, which is bizarre, because most countries around the world claim to abhor this kind of activity. And you're talking to a South African audience where apartheid was done away with by and large, and yet the Israelis are even more apartheid than the South Africans ever were. Can you speak to that?
Well, absolutely. And you mentioned the Indian history here, the Cherokee Trail, the Trail of Tears.
Yeah.
That was the same kind of thing. They were just driven off the land, literally driven off the land. And that is exactly what is happening there. I'm going to read a little bit from the Palestine Monitor, the article called Guns and Olives, just to describe, you know, a day, what transpires, how it happens. And I quote, "As people finally reach the village by taking a long detour to circumvent Israeli roadblocks and started to move into the direction of the olive trees, situated on confiscated land, Israeli military immediately responded by the usual violence employed against anti-wall protesters. In their random manner, soldiers began shooting sound bombs and tear gas grenades, while in the background, bulldozers continued to clear the area by uprooting olive trees for the sake of the wall. The clashes went on for hours, thereby causing men, women, and children, and first aid workers to suffer serious inhalation problems when experiencing the burning and suffocating effects of tear gas. Moreover, ambulance teams for both the Red Crescent and Palestinian Medical Relief Society experienced problems. They were hampered from moving freely and were even misused by Israeli soldiers as shields to force people to leave the area. At the end of the day, ambulances and personnel were prevented from departing." So there you go. That's what's going on. And what is also interesting aspect of this is that, according to OCHA, 80 to 90% of the files open against Israeli settlers following attacks on Palestinians and their property are regularly closed by the Israeli police without prosecution. And that also has a long history, because I remember a couple of years ago.
No surprises there. One of the surprises that I think I want to bring up for my European and American audiences is that there are a very large percentage of the population, I think it's 10 or 15% of the population of Palestine are Christian. Am I correct?
That was once the figure. I don't think it's, it used to be historically, it was about 30%. I think it may be 10 or around there. It's much lower now, and they've left because they've just destroyed them and driven them off. I mean, Bethlehem, they've got this wall going right through the city of Bethlehem. So, and that was a Christian city, and they can't earn a livelihood. I mean, they just can't live.
Yes, I've spoken to the bishop of of Jerusalem from the Anglican Church of Jerusalem, and he said that his parishioners have fallen off so desperately that he's like one tenth of what he used to have as parishioners in his church. But yes, the Christian community has left, as along with the Muslim community. What are we talking about now, too, with water? Can you get into the water problems as well? Because you can't speak about that area without getting involved in talking about water.
Because it's one of the central problems, and it's one of the central ways that the Israelis have destroyed Palestinian farming. And the arable land on the West Bank is now reduced from 28% to 3%. And they've done this through a number of ways, and one of them was by sucking out all the water. And 85% of the water that belongs to the Palestinians is being shuttled, drained, literally drained out, deep well drained, out of the West Bank to Israel and or to the settlements. So,
yeah.
I mean, there are little villages that live at the bottom of the settlements, which inevitably dominate a hillside and control their water and electricity.
Well, I also heard, Jennifer, that even the cisterns that were being built are routinely destroyed so that they're not even able to collect runoff.
That's true. I don't have the number on that. I can't dig up these stats all, you know, out of my mind. But, yeah, they destroyed their wells. They denied the Palestinians access to the Jordan River, which they had rights to. It's just, it's across the board. I mean, the Israeli destruction of the society is an ongoing, everyday kind of event. I mean, for instance, this week, on November 6th, the Palestinian Medical Relief Society noted that the Israeli Army guidelines have been enforced to require the doctors to go through one checkpoint, the Kalandia checkpoint. Well, this means that most doctors have to go way out of their way to get into Jerusalem, so they can't get to work, so they can't staff the hospitals. So this is an assault on the patients of the country, and that's just one week. That's just this week. And what's another thing they do? The subtle ways that they go about destroying Palestinian society. There was an article today from Gaza City, and it was a story about a little boy. Not a little boy, an 18-year-old kid, I guess. He's 28-year-old. And he got a business graduate, got into a business program in a California university. But he can't go. He's got a visa. He's got the acceptance. And the Israelis will not let him leave the Gaza. And as a matter of fact, 1,000 Gazans got scholarships and entry into universities all over the world, and the Israelis only allowed one-third of them to leave. So, you know, I think a lot of people know about, I don't know, I mean, but I'm assuming people know about the embargo and the absolute destruction of life in the Gaza. I mean, just the denial of water, medicine, the port closed for about a year and a half now.
Yeah.
But
well, I heard they were also, the Israelis in the settlements around Gaza were actually pumping raw sewerage toward the Gaza area. And actual Israeli sewerage was finding its way to certain neighborhoods within the Gaza Strip.
That may be, but you know, even before they did that, the Gaza water was sewerage 10 years ago.
Yeah.
This is now ancient history. They, I read some reports, and I posted this. This is in my audio files and also in the book, detailing this, but there was an international study group or a media group that went there and studied the water situation in 1998. And the scientists from Italy noted that the water was so polluted, well, the interviewer could see worms in the glass. the water was so filthy at that point. And this doctor, this scientist said, well, the water has got so many nitrates in it that you could use it as a fertilizer. It's just, as a pesticide, rather. And 50% of the kids were anemic from this. And this was in 1998.
Well, nitrites create a nitric acid environment in the body, and nitric acid is the perfect host for disease.
So, yeah.
Look, you know, I also understand that the West Bank area, now each village that is being destroyed is actually being wiped off the map by the Israelis and by the world press. What you'll find is after a village has been destroyed or taken over, whether it be by the wall or by the Israelis, the following year, you will not see that village printed in any map. You'll see it disappeared. And because the Israelis and their Jewish counterparts worldwide in the printing industry will eliminate that village permanently from the world. And this is an incredible thing to see.
No, it is. I mean, they are actually trying to erase the society. This also has a history. This goes back to 1948, the Israelis who initiated the war on the 50% of the population in the Israeli-designated or the Jewish-designated areas were actually Arab. I mean, the country was so overwhelmingly Arab at that point. So the Israelis assaulted them first before any Arab army showed up. And that story, too, is very exaggerated. But they assaulted these people, and they destroyed or took over 400 villages and renamed them or just leveled them, destroyed them, wiped them out, gone. Gone from history, gone from the map, rubble. So they're doing the same thing. Yeah, it's an erasure of a whole society. I mean, these people are so crazy. This is another headline. This is this week. An Israeli high court ruled on Thursday, this was of last week, that the Israeli occupation government is expected to go ahead and destroy the Muslim cemetery of Ma'amanula in the occupied city of Jerusalem and to build a museum on it. And, of course, they will build, you know, an Israeli Jewish museum on this Muslim cemetery. And this cemetery holds 70,000 tombs of Muslims. So they can't just, you know, go out and kill the living. They have to go out and erase the dead.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, Jerusalem is supposed to be an international city, and that whole concept is actually dying as well. It is becoming a Jewish city by the fact that they're driving these people out of their out of East Jerusalem, and the Palestinians, while they have never relinquished their claim, are being relinquished by the actions of the Israelis. Am I correct in making that assertion?
Absolutely. And that has an interesting history because actually Jerusalem was a Muslim city. Before it was an international city. And this is part of this gradualism. And I remember somebody you had on using that word. And it's a very good word to describe how this takes place. But the city of Jerusalem, before it was claimed by the Israelis, had been a Muslim city for years, 1,300 years. It had been under the control of Muslims, with the exception of 100 years under the Christians. And it's interesting because the population of that city at the time of the Balfour Declaration was 80% Arab. It was about 15% Jewish. It was very small. They had a very tiny population in that city. And they've always used the line, you know, next year Jerusalem, the eternal capital of Jerusalem, and it's just not the truth. I mean, it's a Muslim city. You can go there and see it. And I did. And it is, you know, they have inch by inch moved in. They did this in 67. Well, they first attacked the city, actually, in 48 and tried to take it. And they were pushed back by the international community and told to sign, and they did, sign an agreement that they would recognize the then international character of the city. But then in 67, when they took the West Bank, they took East Jerusalem along with West Jerusalem and claimed it and drove some 80,000 Palestinians out at that time. And they are now, today as I speak, they have settlements inside the old city. I mean, just try to visually imagine that. This very ancient little town. And they've got all these little places where they're setting up their own, they just go into a house and set up a settlement, and they have settlements on the Mount of Olives, and there are settlements all over the back of Jerusalem, on the West Bank, on the hills that surround it, so they have already claimed that city, completely contrary to international law.
Well, you have to understand that the United Nations, the one that that condemns them without any teeth, they just make a declaration and it just filters off into nowhere. That whole setup, the UN, was set up by Jewish extremists from the beginning, and they happen to be Jewish bankers. And if you're a French Connection listener, you'll know that to be true.
Yeah, no, I know. The whole thing was set up to give a quasi-legality. And then they, you know, their whole agenda continues to unravel. And, of course, they have this tremendous influence everywhere, and they continue to, I mean, even in the media, they control the media. But one thing I wanted to talk about, I have a fixation on headlines. And I found this one in the BBC, and it says, Gaza militants fire more rockets. Okay, that's today's headline. Friday, November 7th, 2008. And then you go and you read the story and you find out that, first of all, this exchange was initiated by the Israeli army. They killed 6 militants one day, 7 militants another day, and another on a third day. All of that preceded the return fire by Hamas, and Hamas didn't kill anybody. They didn't damage anything. And still, the headline, of course, implies that it's the Palestinians who are initiating violence. And it's so completely out of balance and distorted. I went and looked on the BBC just to find out for my own satisfaction how many Israelis the Hamas, Qassam rockets really killed. And I came up with the number 16 in 8 years. That's 2 a year. Meanwhile, the Israelis are responsible for the death of 3,249 Gazans.
Yeah.
And we have legislation in the U.S. Congress, and it states, because I've read it, hundreds of Hamas rockets, which of course implies to people, oh my God, you know, thousands of Israelis are dying and under constant assault, and the story is exactly the reverse.
Yeah.
And this is the legislation that initiated this embargo, this absolute cutoff of Gaza from the world. They have destroyed what little economy they had left. I saw a picture of us. You know, they used to export flowers, carnations, tea, and they couldn't export them, so they fed the camels with carnations.
Well, I also heard recently that oil has been discovered directly off the coast of the Gaza Strip, and that, of course, that oil will never be drilled on behalf of the Palestinians, but rather stolen by the Israelis, and they're waiting, they're biding their time to steal it. That's a recent report some 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, no, that's been true. And that was part of the reason, I'm sure, because this whole isolation, you know, that's turning the Gazans into this prisons, they want that oil, of course. Anyway,
well, let's talk about the northern part of Israel and north of Tel Aviv and Haifa, and in the Herzliya area where their Shin Bet and their Mossad work out of. How about the area on just on the border of Lebanon, and what's happening on that northern frontier?
Today I don't know what's going on in Lebanon. I do know, of course, last week, was it October 26th, the U.S. attacked Syria. I don't know what's going on in Lebanon. I mean, they have had this conflict over the land, and it's ages old because, of course, Israel wants to control the Litani River, and that's been one of the reasons for the repeated invasions of the country of Lebanon.
Well, the Sheva Farms thing was a fabrication meant so that they could use it as a cost belli or as an excuse to go into Lebanon, and of course, they found resistance there they didn't expect. Do you have a take on what met the Israelis in Lebanon? Because I think for the first time they really got some on the ground resistance, which is wonderful to hear. And they were actually sent back to Israel with quite a bloody nose. Am I correct?
Are you talking about just recently?
Yes, last year, that attack that they about 18 months now, I guess.
Okay, in 2006. Yeah, that the death rate, I think they got their noses bloody. I think that's true. But they destroyed some $12 billion worth of infrastructure in the country of Lebanon. And again,
yeah,
it was a totally phony excuse. It was two soldiers were kidnapped, and they used this. I mean, that's negotiable. You don't blow up a country over something like this. And they did, and they used it, excuse me, as an excuse to go in there. And they killed some 1,200 Lebanese civilians. And they left the place littered with bombs and ordnance and mines and destroyed billions of dollars way deep into the country of roads and bridges. So they did get their noses bloody, you know, but they inflicted a tremendous amount of damage.
Well, what I've been noticing in my research, Jennifer, is that the Israeli society is so corrupt and so morally bankrupt that they are having trouble keeping their own society willing to do these fights. I mean, the public themselves, while you'll see in the press willingness to take on all these challenges, their public is starting to be so destroyed by their own sickness, and they are a sick society. That is the sickest society on our globe today, and they are the sickest human beings maybe humanity has ever produced. And they're starting to be unwilling to fight the fights, or if they are willing, they're becoming ineffective in some ways because of their own corruption and their own moral decay. And that is, you know, their young people are drug taking, and there's prostitution on every corner of Tel Aviv, and it's just filth in the minds of this entire society. And I'm finding that their own society is beginning to disintegrate under the weight of their own sickness.